This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome. This is our second fireside chat being held here in the Department of Medicine. I'm Bob Wachter, chair of the department. This is Holly Smith. There's a stained glass, a beautiful piece of stained glass there that you may have noticed over the years, but you may not have paid very much attention to. And it has on it, it says University of California, San Francisco, and it says Lloyd Hollingsworth Smith, Jr., 1964 to 1985. Quote, he guided this department to international prominence during his tenure. So those were the years during which he was chair of this department, and that is completely accurate. Holly made this department into what it is today, and it's a great honor for me to serve as chair and actually be the Holly Smith professor.
Hyperbole, but anyhow.
Remarkable. Holly, thank you so much for doing this. Let's go ahead and get started.
All right.
Tell us a little bit about your upbringing.
Well, I'm from a small town in South Carolina. In the Piedmont area, and was born in, this will take up everybody here, in 24, so I'm 93 at the moment, and decided to go into medicine. My grandfather had been a doctor in that town, although he was dead before I was born, but I had an uncle who came through that town in the same public area, and went to Johns Hopkins, and it was rather eminent in developing the vaccine against yellow fever. And in fact, his colleague won the Nobel Prize for that, and commented on his contributions. So he took it to Central and South America and proved its usefulness. And it sounded like a very interesting career to me, so he was one of the ones who moved me in that direction. So then I went to Washington and Lee in Virginia. But the real variable was that Pearl Harbor happened when I was a freshman in college, and that changed the lives and the career goals of virtually everyone in my generation. Being pre-med, they said they would send you to any school that you were accepted in because they knew the war would go on. They would need physicians for some time to come. So I applied and was accepted at Harvard and Penn, Johns Hopkins. Harvard without an interview because it was hard to move around in those days. And so at 19, I found myself in Boston, starting medical school.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we'll fast forward over a fair amount of material.
Yes.
I know one of the seminal contributions you made was to the origins of dialysis. So can you tell us that story and what your particular role was?
Well, at Harvard, for the first time, I met and knew people who weren't just reading about advances in medicine in other people's books, but who were carrying out these advances personally. And there were a number of them. I had my two instructors in third year medicine were Minot and Castle. George Minot got the Nobel Prize for pernicious anemia treatment, and Castle proved the origin of the disease. But I spent some extra time in physiology, and George Thorne was the charismatic chair of medicine at the Brigham Hospital. The Cove kidney was created during World War II in Holland, as a matter of fact, Cove. I met Cove subsequently. So George Thorne had one constructed, and he assigned me and John Merrill, I was a medical student, to see if the damn thing worked. So we set it up, big washing machine type thing. There were no dialysis solutions. We had to figure them out, put them in, use a hose and fill it up at the proper level. Take a stick and mix it. Had sausage casing around this big drum. What he's trying to get at, I know. We didn't have a non-wettable substance. We would suck this blood up and then let it flow down by gravity back into the patient. We finally hit upon a solution. We used condoms. And I, as the youngest member of the team, was sent weekly down to Joe Spar's drugstore to buy new supplies. I was held in very high repute at that moment, but for the wrong reason. In fact, the darn thing worked. Now, obviously, it's been improved tremendously. I had occasion we can, if it interests any of using it during the Korean War, I mean, setting it up in Korea. Yeah.
So you were a resident at Mass General. What was it like back then?
Well, I was an intern and resident there in 48 to 50. Now, I'm not going to say how tough it was in the old days. We lived in the hospital. Our salary was $25 a month. Most of the interns and residents were single, but actually it was easier. Don't listen to those old guys that it was tough in those days. I spent several years on house staff training there and in Columbia. I was never on my feet a complete night on duty for two reasons. Financial considerations did not enter at that point. And two, and this is very interesting, dying people died. Life was a fatal disease. And it was accepted that you would not, you had no ICUs. So you were not up all night adjusting machines and taking blood samples. We did our best with the technology of the day, but we were not driven as much as I've seen subsequently in young people in the last generation or two and nights on duty.
Can you think of, are there a couple of diseases that you can think of now where the treatment or the management is so wildly different than it was, for example, heart attack, or what kind of antibiotics did you have? Do you remember?
Well, we had no antibiotics. There was a little penicillin, which had been left over from World War II, which we would treat very carefully, subacute bacterial endocarditis, and then collect the urine and try to re-extract it. It was so valuable. We could use about 10,000 urine. Sulfonamides had been introduced much more recently, well, in the 30s, late 30s, Prontosil and new developments on that. I think with dismay at the moment of some patients whose lives we could have saved if we'd just known a bit more and the advances had been a little greater. A very attractive young woman who died of idiopathic thrombocytosis, syndic purpura, ITP, bled to death. We didn't know. We didn't have steroids available or even ACTH, which would have saved her. That's not a fatal disease at the moment. So I just remember desperately trying to transfuse her as she bled to death in front of our eyes. I mean, this sort of thing, a year or two later, her life could have been saved by advances in understanding autoimmune disease.
You became chief of endocrinology, as I understand it, at a relatively young age, and I don't believe you're an endocrinologist. Is that right?
That's correct. Well, first I have to describe the old chief of medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital, Walter Bauer, the most colorful figure that I've ever met in medicine. And he transformed that institution in the 1950s. He believed that anyone well-trained in science and well-trained in general internal medicine could learn specialists. They could be picked up and learned later. And he acted on that. So 2 years after I was chief resident, he called me in. He said, "Holly, I think you can make it in academic medicine. I'm going to make you chief of endocrinology to follow the great Walter Bauer. And I'm sorry, Fulbright, who had been incapacitated with Parkinson's disease." He said, "I'm going to give you 5 years." And then he leaned forward and looked me in the eye and he said, "But if you don't make it, I'm going to kick your ass out of here." Those were his exact words. I knew he meant it. I knew he believed in me and he would support me. But by God, if I didn't measure up, I was out of there. Now, I've appointed maybe hundreds of people in my long career. I've never had the nerve to approach anyone like that. But he was effective. He transformed Eselbacher, of course, and G.I. and Swartzen and infectious disease and Crane. And, you know, he transformed with that philosophy the scientific basis of medicine, at least at the MGH in those days. And it was a thrilling time to be there and to participate in this transformation.
So you're there, you're doing extraordinarily well. I assume he didn't kick you out. And all of a sudden this opportunity comes out, comes up for you to come to UCSF. As I understand, UCSF at the time wasn't all that much of a powerhouse. So describe what UCSF was like and what you saw in that opportunity.
Well, meanwhile, I continued in science. In fact, at that moment, I was in Oxford and worked with Sir Hans Krebs of the Krebs cycle. I knew him as one of the many extraordinary figures I've met in a long career. And I got a call from California asking when I came back for the Young Turks meetings, the meetings in Atlantic City, would I come by and be seen as a candidate for the chair of medicine at UCSF. I was 40. I was an assistant professor at Harvard, and they couldn't believe I would come out and look for a chairmanship. "What, you would leave the temple here and go out west?" Yeah, arrogant darn place. Maybe it still is, I don't know. Anyway, it certainly was in those days. So I came in and I spent 2 days, 3 days, and looked intensively. And I was surprised they offered it to me on the spot. I said, "Yes, I've come." I sent a telegram to my wife back at Oxford saying, "Pack." Now, actually, her two brothers had been classmates of my brother and me at Harvard Med. They both moved west. We'd been out here and visited. We had already discussed, if we didn't live in Boston, which we were actually very fond of, where would we like to live in Northern California? But I was afraid to look to it more closely. This is the oldest medical school west of the Mississippi, as most of you know, I think, by now. It's older than Johns Hopkins. In fact, the first president of Johns Hopkins came from University of California. And it was celebrating its first century. There wasn't much to celebrate, however. Stanford had moved out of town down to the farm, its more natural habitat.
So I don't think people know that. So Stanford used to be in San Francisco.
Yes. The medical school was here. They divided the use of the VA. They divided the responsibility for the San Francisco General. So neither school could do very much. So Stanford had gotten the hell out of town. The support from the state was actually rather substantial compared with what. In fact, I asked, why do we have such a small department? There were about 50. They said, well, the state won't give us any more FTEs. Well, I happen to know that Mass General had 3 because I ran the budget of the Department of Medicine there for a while. So that didn't impress me much. And here was this wonderful city. And the jet engine had been introduced into aircraft travel. Now, that's not trivial, because rather than grinding 10 hours to go east or go to the NIH to do things, a sense of isolation, it was 5 hours. So that all of these things were there, and there was malignant complacency in charge, malignant complacency, very dangerous. They thought they were good. Clark Kerr had become president of the university, and he and the first Governor Brown were throwing up new schools. California was booming in some ways, inappropriately with free speech movement, maybe. But things are in flux. So I decided to take a chance. I could have stayed at Mass General. Very happy there. But when you're young, if you're going to take a chance, take it and run with it. So we said, yes, we'll come, and we came. We arrived. We looked desperately for a house. We bought one. We've lived there ever since.
Do you remember what your first house cost here? This is going to be upsetting.
Oh, it was excessive. It was $65,000.
Okay.
In Kentville, you see. Yeah.
Okay.
So anyhow, there was opportunity. So what we did, we found ourselves engaged in a cabal. I never believed that we'd be there, but we found ourselves soon. We, a small group of new people, a new chairman of surgery, and I were deeply involved as the two largest department. And some people locally, the CVRI, Comro, demanding change. And it was touch and go. Front page in this Chronicle. Bitter power struggle at UC Med Center. Pictures. The graduates, the alumni, the clinical faculty came out against these new rat doctors from the East who were trying to shake things up. And so, but finally, Kerr backed us, and we got rid of the chancellor and the chance to make new appointments on merit, and we brought in Grumbach and pediatrics, who unfortunately died recently, as many of you know, and Fishman in neurology, changed these departments, and surgery had turned over at that time. So we were able to make changes very quickly. And brought in new people more interested in research as well as patient care.
Was that the, as you talk about the cabal, and I'm trying to picture myself making a move 3,000 miles where you felt like the culture wasn't a very good culture with this malignant complacency. In some ways, it was dependent on you changing the leadership and changing the attitude. How did you know you were going to be able to do that?
I didn't, but it was worth a shot. If you're going to make a change and take a chance, that is the time to do it when you are young and feisty, and if it didn't fail, you could go elsewhere. In fact, at the same time, I was offered the chair at UC San Diego, way against it. It was just a new school being created at that time. So I thought the potential was here with this luminous city, good public support, tied in with Berkeley, which was obviously a superb public university. And why couldn't we be the medical equivalent of Berkeley in this area? So we jumped for it and took some risk, and it seemed to go. Now, my own contributions, I think it may be in many ways, were in basic science. I was a member of the, I'd spent 3 or 4 years in organic chemistry and laboratory science. I was a member of the American Society of Biological Chemists and was made chair of the search committee for redoing the basic science aspects. And after devious and prolonged search, we managed to bring in Bill Rutter. Everyone here should know the name of Rutter, who has been a tremendous addition to this area and is still at it. The rascal's still running around setting up companies that he's 88. Now, a very close friend of mine, and Gordon Tompkins. And they set up a revolution so that within 15 years, rather than having one member of the National Academy of Science here, I think there were 40.
So it was really the beginnings of the biotech movement.
Exactly. And Nobel Prizes. Recombinant DNA, which should have won the Nobel Prize, but in fact, it did not. Oncogenes, for example. And the whole atmosphere of the scientific community was turned around. And in fact, they said that one of the junior members of the Department of Biochemistry got so scientific, he sent 2 of his children to Sunday school and he kept 2 home as controls. I don't know that that actually happened or what the outcome of that was. But meanwhile, in the clinical sciences, Dr. Dunphy, who was a new chair of surgery, and I flew to the Washington, went to the VA and said, we don't want to be associated with a second-rate institution unless you put some new resources in this we're going to pull out. Now, we may have been bluffing. But the VA at that time was advertising, trying to fill its complement of health staff. So they backed us, and I was able to bring in Marvin Schlesinger, who everybody should know. Unfortunately, he's in bad health. But he had been passed over as chair at Cornell through anti-Semitism, and he was a classmate in medical school, and he was able to come out. And he and his close associates transformed the VA. It's a very academic institution, as you know. And then we approached the city and sort of wrestled control of the appointments at the San Francisco General, recruited new leadership there. And once that happened, we were able to set up the 3 hospital system, which is the strength of the clinical program at this institution.
I want to look to hear more about that, because I think if you talk to a lot of the residents, part of the reason they came here is the 3 hospital system. So when you came out and you were trying to build up the VA and build up the county, was that intentional in part?
Yes.
For, it sounds like in part for the science, but in part because you thought it would be a better training ground than
exactly
the comparable programs back east?
Yes, Moffitt Hospital just had more or less esoteric patients which were referred in from around the state. And the residents who wanted good training would then apply independently to spend some time at the San Francisco General to get the acute experience.
Oh, was it a separate training program?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Separate. And the VA was a weak third in that regard. So we were able to tie these together and show the flag. The three chiefs, changing chiefs out at the San Francisco General, would make chief rounds 3 days a week, and then the fourth day would make chief rounds at the other hospital to show that this was a single universe and that we were deeply interested in all of them. And so that improved. Our focus was on house staff education. We focused sharp because that is the public that you turn, that you are defined by, the house staff. We took immense pride in the medical house staff of those days. And they're an extraordinary group, as you know.
Still are.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming that this continues. You better be. I just don't know you, of course, the current house staff. But our house staff from those days that I was chair, 21 years, were either subsequently chair of medicine or dean at Yale, Cornell, Columbia, Penn, Johns Hopkins, Dallas, Stanford. I mean, these, I don't mean that we just wanted to excrete them all, you know, we wanted to keep them here, as many of them. But that was the quality of the training and the reputation of the group. So we took immense pride in the house there. And then later, once that was settled, we got more involved in undergraduate focus. And other people have taken that up. We were not the pioneers in that, but I was on something called GPEP, the General Professional Education of the Physician. And that's when Harvard got its new pathway. And we got the concept that the main problem with medical education is that it leads to graduation. Should not. MD is moderately done. So you're supposed to not graduate, but transfer from UCSF to your own medical school where you are the faculty and continue. Otherwise, you will become a danger over years. You have to continue your education. I mean, yeah, these are common concepts at the moment. And then we worked on the standing in research. My appearance here doubled the number of members of the Association of American Physicians. I came here, went from one to two.
That's a very prominent honor society in academic medicine. Yeah.
And now, I think it had 80 to 100 or something.
How many faculty were here when you came?
50 full-time.
50 full-time.
Because they...
In medicine or all of UCSF?
No, this is medicine.
In medicine.
Yeah.
So about 800 today.
Yes, I'm aware of that. You about to outgrow your blood supply. You better be careful here. Anyhow.
Yeah.
But we all knew each other. It was a much smaller, more intimate place. And we worked together. We were all involved in finding a new chair for pediatrics or finding a new chair for neurology. When these openings came, we met together as a group with a sense of common purpose, not competitive for limited resources, for example. So I did this for 21 years, and it got to be a little wearing because I got involved in a number of other things. That's interesting. I worked for Richard Nixon. I'm a Democrat, I'm quick to say, but I was on the President's Science Advisory Committee. I worked for the Shah of Iran.
On the advisory committee. You knew how to pick them, huh?
What?
You knew how to pick them.
Yeah. But more important, I worked for the Howard Hughes.
Did you meet, you met Hughes?
No, never nobody met Hughes except a few handlers. He was insane by that point. No, we dealt through handlers. But we foresaw its growth from 5,000, let's say about a $5 million operation to about a $500 million operation over a few years.
So this is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute?
HHMI, which is a main support of academic medicine outside of the NIH. So I did that for some years. In fact, I got to be chair of that thing. Got involved in textbooks with my friend Weingarten, who was chair of medicine at Duke. He's a transient fame, you know. He's been forgotten probably, but he was a professor at Duke, and one of the first people to set up the MD, PhD training programs, and was director of the NIH for a while. And he's still alive, and I keep in touch with him, but diminished like many of us, right?
Can I ask you about mentorship? Sounds like you named a few key mentors. What do you think makes a good mentor, and can you think of advice that you got from mentors that was particularly meaningful to you?
My mentors gave me advice, not so much verbally, but by surrogate. I mean, by example. You would identify, I would say my mentors were George Thorne at the Brigham, and Walter Bauer at the MGH. And those were the ones that they didn't sit me down and give me lectures of mentorship, but they demonstrated qualities that I admired and that I would like to. So I don't, I guess I've been a mentor for a number of people, but not through lecturing them. I'll say one thing of mentorship. We have a profession which can be all-consuming. So we need to know the difference between commitment and obsession. No matter how committed you are, one should retain some aspects and participate in the pageantry of one's time. Save back. There's no recorded deathbed statements. I wish I had devoted more time to my profession. I don't think anyone's ever recorded that. They may have said, okay, I wish I'd spend a little more time with my family and friends and participating in what's going on in the world during their time. So, I've had a number of people who I've admired, and not all of them were older people. Some were younger, younger than, well, everybody's younger than I am now, for practical purposes, when you come down to it. So, I think the thing to do, you are, and I was, a member of a wonderful profession with so many opportunities and so many directions. I want you to go for it and enjoy it, but save back a core of your being and not become obsessed by it. I happen to have a not a family, but a biomass.
So how many children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren now?
6 children, 17 grandchildren. And I have to kind of count how many great-grandchildren, because it changes. I think currently only about 5. Yeah.
Now, one thing you are best known for are your Holly Smith-isms. They're little sayings that are kind of words to live by. Do you have any favorites, and how did you come to doing that?
I didn't make most of these up. I mean, heard them from other people and happened to have a long memory for them, I guess. Yeah. Well, the advice I got from one of my friends when I was coming out here says, I'll teach you the secret of success. Dress British, think Yiddish. Now, I've been working on that one for a long time. As a lapsed small-town Calvinist Southerner, I haven't quite figured that one out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they're all things. The Peter Pan principle, if you get an administration, most things peter out, but some will pan out. So keep trying. Try new things and see what sticks and what does not. And also, blow the horn. You have to get out there and play the, well, I shouldn't call it a game, but play the profession with the young people. A distant virtue is rarely appreciated, although more effective. Blow the horn, or somebody might use it as a funnel.
Yep.
And a lot of little things like that are attributed to me, but I picked up from other people. Mostly, I did.
One of my favorites was, I remember you began saying, I've reached the age that when I reach down to tie my shoes, I ask myself, is there anything else I need to do as long as I'm down here, which I particularly enjoyed.
That's a definition of getting old.
Yeah.
But I think that was Jack Benny or someone. I think that's been in the public arena. Yeah.
As you, maybe my last question will open up. Any, as you look at medicine today, academic medicine today, any observations that things that worry you and kind of the direction things are going in, or things that you're particularly excited about?
Well, obviously it's very successful with the new science, the way skipping up and down the DNA and stitching it here and cutting it there. And I mean, what can be done now in an afternoon by a postdoc who would have won the Nobel Prize many times over when I was involved in science and spent several years in laboratories, organic chemistry, isotopes, and intermediate pathways, and made some modest contributions in the science of that time. But it's wonderful what can be done at the moment. What does worry me a little bit in academic centers is that we're getting so big. I'm not criticizing the fact that they're getting big. The communication between those in the forefront of patient care and those who are in the forefront of medical advances is not as intimate as in the old days. We knew each other, and we took pride in each other, and we were good friends, and we would support the dean, and if there was a shortage of money to recruit a promising young basic scientist, the clinical department would kick in and help if they could. We were unified as an academic community. And right now, the basic scientists, at least some of them who complain to me a little bit about it, that they don't feel like they're as central to UCSF as they were when they were winning Nobel Prizes and doing all these great things a generation ago. Most of you know that Stan Prusna started in the Department of Medicine as an intern in medicine. And you know who Prusna is, and he won the Nobel Prize for prions, and probably the most revolutionary finding, a revolutionary contribution that's come from this place. Joe Goldstein, who's a good friend of mine, Brown and Goldstein are the patron saints of clinical investigation. I almost had him recruited one time. But Joe says that's the single most striking concept, that a protein could be infectious just through its shape. So Stan was an intern. I'll tell you this little story. It may be amusing. At the end of his internship, he came to see me. He said, Dr. Smith, we are good friends. I'm going to go out on the Golden Gate Bridge and drop my stethoscope in the Pacific Ocean. I said, Stan, that's not a bad idea. We laughed about that. Then he went off and got to the NIH, and I got in, helped get him a Howard Hughes investigatorship to saw him through some of those years. And no, we have fun over that, and he's done remarkably well.
Let me throw it open to any of you.
Hi, my name is Ralph Brindis, and for context, I was an intern here in 1977, did my residency and chief residency at UCSF. And a couple comments. First of all, I want you all to know that Holly was and is one of the most revered chiefs of medicine and physicians that we've had at UCSF. You know, one of the things that in particular the house staff loved at Holly, which you mentioned, is your chief rounds. We loved them. And we tried to stump you. It was very hard. You knew everything from hemochromatosis to schizophrenia, and it was a total joy. You also talked about the leadership, the hiring of all the people that you had, but I would like to comment that I was a little concerned about your hiring, because we had a house staff faculty tennis tournament every year. And I was convinced that Holly hired his research attendings on the basis of their tennis ability, so the faculty would always win. You also mentioned all the leaders that you created here at UCSF with all these leadership positions over time. But what in particular all of us admired was your leadership ability, not just within the university, but also your interactions with all the chiefs of medicine across the country. And so my question to you is, what are some of the skills that our future leaders here in this room should be trying to emulate that make us great leaders?
You didn't expect me to answer that.
I think that was a question at the end.
No. What makes a great leader?
Well, I think a sense of valuing the contribution of others, not believing that you uniquely hold the keys to the kingdom and know the answer, that you're willing to learn with time and experience, just like younger people do at that point. And then you hope to have an innate sense of the difference between A- and A+. there are a lot of competent people to try to pick out the very special ones who may or may not be the closest friends you have, who are likely to do something significant in medical research or medical education. And that's instinctive and not always correct. Yeah, I mean, you take some chances. Yeah, but especially when one is young in that regard. I took a lot of chances, and many of them turned out well. We had some failures as well.
I want to follow up on Ralph's question, which is when you talked about Bauer being such a role model, and yet he had a style of leadership that in some ways you never had, more autocratic, more a style that might not have fit in UCSF, might not have fit in over time. So how do you figure out sort of what pieces to take from leaders, but what pieces that might not actually work for you or might not work for the context?
I didn't have a formula for that. I think this is all built into one's own experience, background, personality, parents, a lifestyle, value systems, rather than any formula for it in that regard. I wish I could give you an answer to that.
It's a good idea. It has to be authentic to you.
And some people are good at it, and some people are not. Some people are lucky at it, maybe.
Yeah.
And people instinctively work well with them and enjoy working well with them, and others, they don't.
Yeah.
And I think that's a basic question in personality and psychology that's... which there's no easy.
Well, it struck me that you took from Dr. Bauer, you took the idea of demanding excellence and driving people to be as good as they could be, but then turned it into your own, a style that was authentic to you.
Yes, I would never operate like Bauer. Well, he was senior to us, and we were just beginning, and he was renovating the department at the Mass General, and his changes there reverberated throughout the nation, actually. A lot of other schools started doing that, and with physician scientists and putting them in charge of specialty units in that regard. I don't know whether anyone here spent time at the MGH, but... he still percolated. The people he set in motion there. He are still, most of them are dead now, of course, but.
Let's hear from Dr. Jacobs.
Yes, I am Dick Jacobs. I came here as an intern in 1974 and got to witness a lot of Holly's career here, and as wonderful as it was. I hesitate to ask this because I've been a real proponent of another one of your Hollyisms, which is don't speak unless you can improve on silence. But I will ask this question anyway, and that is out of all the time that you've been here, your illustrious career, any regrets or anything that you would do differently if you could do it again?
Well, not in the gestalt, and not in the overall, any deep regrets. I think we, at the moment, did the right thing in this to help allow this institution to reach its potential, or start to reach its potential. And I think we can all who participated take pride in the fact that, in fact, that the American Society for Clinical Investigation, which is, you know, the working group for the physician scientists, 2 years ago said that over the past generation, UCSF and Dallas had risen most strikingly as institutions in medicine. and now was at least the equal of the traditional leaders in the East, of Hopkins and Harvard and Penn and what have you. So we can all take pride in that. But it was a communal effect. And the real question, why it didn't happen before, that's why I say complacency is the dry rot of an institution. And it was complacent here. And the Clark Kerr was aware of this.
The president of the University of California.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I assumed everybody knew Clark Kerr, but I keep forgetting that that was a generation ago. I got to know him later on, met and talked with him, and I was a great admirer of Clark Kerr. I introduced him at some setting, and I said something about he had been one of the builders of the University of California, and until he had resigned to pursue other pursuits in higher education. He said it was a nice introduction, but I want to make a key correction. I both entered and left the university under exactly the same circumstances, fired with enthusiasm.
That's a very, very famous line. All right, we will stop. Holly, this has been delightful and instructive, and thank you for everything you've done for us and for doing this.
Well, it's been a great privilege of my life to have this part of my career, most of my career, at UCSF, and to be associated with so many gifted and talented people who collectively have done this. It's not, I happen to be beating the drums, but it was a community affair. Right.
Great. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.